This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, President Bush has a change of heart. He's now pushing to renew all parts of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Also, is the U.S. paying Iraqi newspapers to pump up the rep of American troops? Joining us to find out what's behind the news are, from our New York bureau, E.R. Shipp, a columnist for the New York Daily News, and Pedro Noguera, professor at the Steinhardt School of Education at New York University, plus George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service in Laurel, Maryland. Thank you all for joining me, and let me jump right in with a surprising announcement. President George Bush, yesterday at the ceremonies marking Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, says that he will push for Congress to renew the provisions of the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act that are set to expire. This is something that he wasn't very vocal about before. George, what's behind this?
I don't know, but I think you should give him credit. That's a good thing. He had meetings earlier. I remember Congressman Jackson, Jesse Jackson Jr., saying basically he had raised that issue before, and Bush didn't even know what he was talking about. So, I mean, I don't know what his ultimate agenda is other than trying to climb him out of the basement with these ratings, but I think it's a good idea, and it should be applauded.
ER, what about you? Is this, I mean, obviously it seems like time to applaud on a substantive level, but what about the politics of it?
Well, he knows, as George pointed out, that he is at bottom in terms of popularity, but he's never really been that popular among blacks. So I don't know whether he's trying, through this particular act, to win over blacks and perhaps other minorities for the Republican Party that he leaves behind when he leaves office. So he may be thinking legacy right now. The Civil Rights Act, or the Voting Rights Act itself, was never really totally in jeopardy. There were just certain provisions. But there was such hysteria over the last few years, partly fueled through the internet, with people thinking that all voting rights protected by that 1965 law were in jeopardy.
Let me just jump in there. Mm-hmm. You know, I got those emails too. Oh, your voting rights are about to end. But even if it was hysteria and urban myth to a certain amount, or political myth, don't you think that hysteria actually got people to ask their congresspeople what's going on? In a weird way, didn't those rumors actually help the groundswell of support for renewing the Voting Rights Act?
Well, actually, they did. And it forced the Justice Department to set up its own website to refute the urban myths, if you will. But having said all that, that's been going on for several years now. And the idea that the president didn't know anything about that controversy tells us a lot. It gives Jay Leno something to work with.
Now, Professor Noguera, let me ask you to explain a little bit more about the significance of the Voting Rights Act. Some people said, well, why renew it? We already have voting rights. It's in the Constitution. What's the big deal here?
Well, the provisions in the act are to ensure access to voting, to ensure that the rights of blacks and others who have been denied that, the right to vote historically will be protected. As E.R. just pointed out, the non-renewal would not have prevented blacks from voting, but it would have made it more difficult for the federal government to enforce those rights as it has under the provisions of the act. So I think in some ways it's a symbolic measure, and in many ways you could see it as damage control. Why would Bush want to add to his troubles by having yet another controversy to deal with? And this will just simply eliminate this matter from one of the many other problems he's got to deal with.
I think we need to point out that some of these, you know, we're talking about important provisions of the Voting Rights Act, such as pre-clearance. And these are districts, let's be clear, these are districts that have a record of disenfranchisement, and they're the ones that are held to higher standards. I mean, you cannot change your voting jurisdiction or areas or laws without being pre-cleared by the Justice Department. Another important one is not just for African Americans. Another important one is the language requirements for Latinos, saying that, you know, they should be able to have Spanish as well as English. So these are important issues that need to be renewed.
Now, you talked a little bit about the Justice Department doing pre-clearance, but I think one of the issues there, too, is that, as we've seen in many news reports, including in the Washington Post, the Justice Department, long-term officials are leaving. Newer officials seem less likely to really push for voting rights. In fact, in the case in Georgia about the ID system, the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department said, okay, go ahead, put this ID system into place when, in fact, many other judiciaries or judicial branches said, wait, you know, this is a voting rights infringement. So is there really the backbone, even if the law continues to enforce the law, ER?
That depends upon what happens in the elections next year, I think, largely. The Democrats are now getting excited, thinking they have a chance to gain more power in Washington. If that's the case, then one would presume that there would be more backbone to enforce, to actually scrutinize some of these efforts around the country to control who has access to the ballot, and then to challenge those that seem to be detrimental to the extension of the voting to various folks who are disenfranchised.
And Professor Nogueira, if in fact the Voting Rights Act relies on the Justice Department to really enforce it, if that department doesn't seem as interested in this process as it did maybe 20, 30 years ago, what other recourses do people have?
Well, I think we're going to have to file lawsuits. That's the way, unfortunately, it's worked in the past. And I think there are a range of voting issues that are important that and obstacles, particularly the use of these electronic machines that would seem to not record votes accurately in certain polling places, and a number of others. And so I think that if the Justice Department doesn't take the lead, then we're going to have to rely on the courts and file lawsuits.
Let me actually move on to another bit of controversy. You had mentioned previously that this was a potential controversy for the Bush administration. Now we have yet another one combining the issues of the U.S. military and the issues of journalism. Of course, we saw people like Armstrong Williams being paid to write certain types of commentaries on the government's budget. Now the Los Angeles Times is reporting that the U.S. military has been accused of skewing information in Iraqi newspapers, getting U.S. troops, information officers, to actually plant stories. And I just want to take a particular slice of this that I found hilarious in a not straightforwardly funny way. This U.S. operative paid cash, left no calling card, went to this well-respected newspaper, paid them $1,200 to place an article. The editor of the paper said that if his cash-strapped paper had known these stories were from the U.S. government, he would have, quote, charged much, much more, end quote, to publish them. So who's getting played here?
Well, I think the Iraqi people are being played. I mean, if you think about it, we were supposed to be in Iraq to restore democracy. And it's clear now we've exchanged dictatorship for chaos, and democracy may, in fact, look like the mullahs of Iran taking power in the next election. This is a disaster, and the fact that they would have to plant stories suggests that they really don't understand what it means to develop democracy, because free press has always been the cornerstone of democracy. So I think it, again, speaks to the failure of this policy.
George, what about... Go ahead.
Go ahead. You would think that the Bush administration would have learned something. You know, not only did they have Armstrong leave no money left behind, there were several other reporters involved as well. They had distributed these fake news videos, or let's not forget that the GAO called covert propaganda. So here it is, and a general put it best in the original LA Times story. He said, here we are trying to create the principles of a democracy in Iraq, and what we're doing is breaking all of the first principles of democracy while doing it. It makes the U.S. look bad. It undermines our credibility.
ER?
It definitely undermines credibility. And it's also causing a morale problem among those officers who are having to deal with this program. Some think it's really appalling, and that's how the press in this country has learned about what was going on. Obviously, these officers who are upset have helped to lead the way to the documents showing who's being paid to write what or to broadcast what, and then to be able for our media to be able to follow up with the Iraqis and figure out what's going on. Many of the Iraqis did not know that these freelance articles they were being asked to place. Sometimes, of course, they place them as advertisements because they were being paid to put these articles in their papers and weren't quite sure of their origin. They nevertheless took the money and would try to find ways to distinguish them from their news stories. In any case, they had no idea that the middlemen that they were dealing with were really representing the United States government, or at least the U.S. military. So that's now caused friction within the military, and it's caused us perhaps to lose more credibility with those genuine Iraqi publications, many of them struggling, that want it to be exemplars of a democratic press.
Let me ask a question a little bit to the side of this issue. We are talking about stories placed in Iraqi newspapers, but what about our understanding of how Iraqis feel? How good has the U.S. media been recently in trying to give a picture of what people in Iraq actually feel? Because there's not just one type of Iraqi. There are many people with different views, different ethnicities. George, is it important for us to try to understand what their perspective is on this conflict?
It's important to understand their perspective, and not only that, if we want to engage in a debate or discussion, we should try to persuade them on the strength of our arguments. Now, this thing was so subtle, they go in and start quoting the Quran and try to use different things, talk to refer specifically to Muslim. The whole thing was just a fiasco. So, you know, you should rise or fall on your arguments.
But, you know, lately I have heard, and I wonder myself what the basis would be, but I've heard a reference to polls of Iraqi people, and I juxtapose that with stories of correspondents in the field who periodically are on television talking about how they actually do their work, and they rarely leave their safe compound or the hotel rooms that they're in. So I'm trying to figure out who's conducting a poll and who are they polling?
You're absolutely right. There is, I have heard, just an unprecedented amount of danger for journalists as well as for citizens and military people, and it is very difficult to gather the news. Professor Nogueira, how important is it for people to, you know, seek the information about what, again, what Iraqis feel and also what U.S. military overseas feel? I remember at the beginning of the war, there seemed to be a lot more focus on getting people in the military to, you know, who were not at the top echelons, to speak a little bit about their experiences. I don't seem to see that quite as much now.
Well, I think that this is a very important issue. We were told at the beginning of this war that the Iraqis would greet us with roses and welcome us as liberators. Obviously, that didn't happen. We just found out last week that several parties in Iraq have come together to ask the Americans to set a date for withdrawal. Now, that's news, too, because we were led to believe it was only people like Cindy Sheehan who wanted the Americans out of Iraq. And now we're hearing Iraqis themselves, of all the major parties, saying they want the Americans to leave. So I think understanding Iraqi opinion, and obviously it's going to be varied and quite diverse, is essential if we're going to have some sense of what's going on in the country and how we as a nation need to engage Iraq.
But Farah, that reminds me of something you said, that when we were hearing more from the troops on the field, remember that was because journalists have been embedded with the troops. So that was, again, one of those public relations ploys aimed at giving us up close and personal, but from a very limited perspective.
So you think now it might be more dangerous
probably,
to the you know, the aims of people in PR?
Yes, and also because the troops have been in the field so long, and some of them are on their second and third tours, so it might not be as positive of press. But I don't get the impression that as many journalists are now embedded in the way they were at the start of this war to show how wonderfully we would come in and be received and be able to fight the war and leave and go home.
Well, let me actually turn to one last topic, very short, very light. Several critics are accusing the NCAA of manipulating a longstanding rule not to pay student athletes. The organization seems willing to use college athletes to help promote the sale of commercial products and services, but they don't get paid for it. So there's a website, the Pontiac Game Changing Performance Poll. It showcases the players, but they don't actually get paid because they're in college. Now, do you think that the NCAA is violating its own rules against using college players in a commercial way? What about that, ER? Oh, actually, George, go ahead.
They are actually coming awfully close if they have not crossed that line on this. I mean, I understand why people say you shouldn't pay athletes. At the same time, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry that the colleges all make money off of, and coaches are making big, fat $5 billion contracts. I mean, there's a lot of money involved. Everybody, it seems, gets paid but the athlete, but yet everybody's making money off of it. So I think that NCAA is going too commercial with this, and they certainly should not involve the athletes themselves.
ER, is it fair to them, the athletes?
Well, I go with the argument that you can say the athletes are gaining something from being involved in NCAA activities.
They can be members of the NAACP
they can be that too.
But
NCAA activities. They're gaining an education, should they take advantage of it, of course. And there are many perks that come with that. The schools are getting money that helps to provide more scholarships, etc. So they are being beneficiaries in an indirect way. The question with this using their image is a little difficult, but it comes to the NCAA parsing words the way our friend Bill Clinton did. You know, what does is mean or whatever.
Well,
so
they're
trying to parse their own rules.
Right. Let me turn to Professor Nogueira. We're almost out of time. You are at New York University. Are the colleges getting too much out of this deal?
Well, not New York University. We don't have Division I sports. But I would say that, yes, the colleges have been getting a lot out of the deal for many years. The athletes, most of the athletes don't even get an education out of the deal. And certainly very, very few get to become professional athletes. So it's an exchange that's very unequal. The athletes are being exploited. They're willingly exploited in most cases. But the fact is that if we're going to keep the money and make this such a big money-making enterprise, then we need to eliminate the hypocrisy that this is about education and actually pay these athletes salaries and make sure that they are able to be supported while they're entertaining the college campuses they're on.
So give them a degree or give them money, but give them something. We've got Pedro Nogueira. He's a professor in the Steinhardt School of Education at New York University. Also, E.R. Shipp, a columnist at the New York Daily News. And George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service from Laurel, Maryland. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks.